Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. My name is David Inge. I'm the host. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain is at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about French politics and about what we might expect from the recently elected president. In May, voters there in France elected Nicolas Sarkozy to be president. He is in many ways different from his predecessors. He is politically conservative. He is young. His style is rather different, certainly from that of his predecessor, Mr. Chirac. He is the first French president born after World War II. He served as the interior minister, was someone well known for taking a hard line on issues of law and order. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking a bit about what his election means for France and for its relations with the rest of the world, including the United States. And our guest is Jeremy Shapiro. He is a fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. He's also director of research at the Center on the U.S. and Europe. In addition, he is an adjunct professor of security studies at Georgetown University, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, and we'll pay for the call, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL or 9455, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Shapiro, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us. Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. Just as a way of starting out here, perhaps we'll talk about the fact that here, when the election, when we came down to the runoff at the end, it seems that the people of France had a pretty clear choice between the two candidates, Mr. Sarkozy and Ségolène Royal, who was the Socialist Party candidate, people who certainly were very different, had different kind of political agendas and different outlooks. And certainly there was a lot of interest in this election. I was very, very struck by the turnout, something like more than 84% turnout.
Quite extraordinary,
so that's, you know, particularly when you think about what turnout here is in our elections. So people were obviously interested, obviously motivated in turning out. When you take a look at these two candidates, do you think that there were particular issues on which voters made their choice? Was it something to do with the two candidates themselves and their personalities? What really do you think made the difference?
It's a good question. It's, you know, of course, it's a little bit of psychology to try to figure something like that out. But I mean, there was a couple of issues on which the French election really turned, which was what absorbed the attention. One was economic reform, and they offered very different visions of that. And the other was integration, the question of how to deal with particularly Muslim immigrants and integrate them into French society. And they also offered very different visions of that.
Mm-hmm. I think the pre-election polls predicted that Mr. Sarkozy would win, as he did, but also certainly there, I recall in that time, there were certainly comments, reporters went out and talked to people on the street, and there were certainly comments from people who were concerned about his conservatism, his place on the political spectrum.
Yeah,
thought
definitely.
Maybe he was way too far to the right.
I wouldn't say it's specifically that he's too far to the right in his policies. It's more that he's a somewhat frightening figure. I guess it's not too much to say that. A lot of people in France are scared by him because he has a certain tendency toward megalomania and a certain tendency toward believing that anybody who opposes him is evil and is attempting to undermine the interests of the French state. And so he has tremendous energy, tremendous drive, tremendous talent, but he doesn't brook criticism very well, which is sort of seen as a not very French trait. And so he scared people, I think. But in the end of the day, his energy and his policy proposals were, I think, so much stronger than Ségolène Royal's that people put aside their qualms about his personality and elected him anyway.
Hmm. Now, also just recently, there were parliamentary elections, and here it was interesting that while the party of Mr. Sarkozy still has control, they have the greatest number of seats, they actually lost ground and the socialist gained. And here, where we were talking about the turnout in the presidential balloting being so high, here turnout was much less. So now what the fact that people seem to be less motivated to vote here and less motivated to vote for his party, what does that tell you, or does that tell you anything?
Well, I think it tells us a few things. I mean, first of all, the notion that there would be less people voting in the legislative elections is quite normal. And the legislative elections just aren't as interesting as presidential elections here or in France. This certainly wasn't a repudiation of Mr. Sarkozy just a month after he was elected. I would say that it didn't quite align with the expectations of what he might achieve. He might have achieved in the legislative elections. He still has a fairly substantial majority in the assembly. His party lost about 40 out of 577 seats, which is a significant setback. And one of the major members of his government, Alain Juppé, lost his seat and had to resign, so that created a degree of shuffle. I think that there were a couple of factors in this defeat. The first is, referring back to what I said about Sarkozy, he is not the kind of guy that people are comfortable giving all the reins of power to. I think that there's an innate sense in the French population that there needs to be some degree of balance with Mr. Sarkozy. And in fact, there is very little at the moment. The French president, by design, is a very powerful office. He has still a lot of control of the electorate. If he had increased his seats, his mandate for change would have been quite overwhelming. Mm. Secondly, and more mundanely, his government really made its very first misstep in the lead-up to this election, in that it leaked the possibility that it might raise the VAT, the value-added tax, essentially the sales tax, about 5%. To pay for some of the reductions in taxes that they're planning in other areas. And this was really not a good announcement in the week before an election. And it does seem to have hurt them in some of the more marginal districts.
Yeah. In the presidential race, there was someone who was in the middle, a man named François Bayrou. And I suppose if people had thought, well, maybe the one guy's too far to the right and the other guy, the other woman, Ségolène Royal's maybe too far to the left, they thought, well, I'll play it down the middle. But he didn't really seem to have much support at all. Was that not a reasonable thing to think, that people would have said, well, maybe I'll take somebody who was somehow in the center?
I think it was a reasonable strategy, and it seemed as if that he might make it happen, actually, at a certain point in the election. There was a time when people were, when the socialists, the left-wing party, were very nervous that the center party would overtake them. I think in the end it didn't happen because there was a realization in France that that things needed to be done. What Bayrou was offering, the centrist candidate was offering, was sort of an end to partisanship. The hope that we can have reform without really having much pain. And that's an attractive proposition, obviously, but I think that after there had been so little movement in French politics in the last really 20 years, the notion that there wasn't going to have to be serious measures of one type or another, I think was something that the French population was no longer willing to buy.
Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580, Jeremy Shapiro. He's a fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution, where he's also director of research at the Center for the U.S. and Europe. And we're talking about French politics and the recent election. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm interested in having, perhaps you talk a little bit more about Mr. Sarkozy, and so much of what I have read, it talks about his personal style how different he is, certainly different from Jacques Chirac, being very, very energetic, doing a lot of public physical fitness. I thought there was a funny piece that we kind of funny piece we pulled off from Reuters yesterday about the fact that French winemakers are unhappy because he doesn't drink. And I figured that's the wrong example to be. He's doing much exercising. He doesn't drink. That's not the kind of guy that we really want at the helm. Is he in his personal style? Is he really so much different from other kinds of political leaders that the French have had before?
I think in his style, he really is. He has the image of a sort of self-made man, which is very different than previous French leaders. He's extremely pragmatic, extremely and openly ambitious in a way which wouldn't have been de rigueur, if I can use a term, for most French leaders. He makes a lot of the fact that his father was an immigrant from Hungary, and so he doesn't come from the usual elite background and the usual elite schools that French leaders have tended to come from. Having said that, his personal style is definitely distinct in all the ways that you and I both mentioned. His policies are actually quite consistent with the Gaullist tradition that he comes from. And in fact, his policies aren't radically different from what has been proposed in the past by French governments, including Jacques Chirac's government that just left. The distinction that he himself really makes is that he plans to be able to implement it. The French governments have never had a shortage of ideas about what to do. They've always had a shortage of follow-through because they've been challenged by the bureaucracy, by the unions, by street protests, by various civil society actors. What Sarkozy is saying is not, I am ideologically so distinct from anything you've seen before, but that I am pragmatically very distinct, and that I am somebody who gets things done, who is for action, who has energy, and will not be deterred by the politics of the street.
And certainly here, though, he would have to contend with all those same challenges. And I'm sure that there are people on the left in France and people who are involved in labor and all kinds of people who would not greet happily some of the economic and labor kinds of reforms that he's talked about making. So presumably he's going to, maybe he thinks he can take those things on, but they are. You would have to think they're going to be significant challenges.
Absolutely. I think that there is a lot of difficult times ahead. I think we can predict that they will start as soon as this fall. He is true to his style. He has started with a huge raft of very controversial reforms and going right at the established and usually very vociferous interest groups, the unions, the students, the pensioners even. And this means that, of course, he's doing this early and hard because he's trying to ride the wave of his popularity. They're going to need to take rather serious measures to oppose it. And I think we can expect a rather hot autumn, as they say in France, with a fair amount of protests. The question will be, I think, two things. First, how will the sort of silent majority of the population respond to what is almost an inevitable protest? One of the distinct things about France, and one of the problems that French governments had in implementing policies like this in the past, is that when people come out to the streets and demonstrate in favor of fairly narrow interests, say youth employment or university privileges or something like that, they get a lot of sympathy from the broader population because street protest has a really sort of touches the French soul, and people approve of it much more than they do in other countries, in other democratic countries. And so the question is, after having been through many waves of this and having elected a president on a fairly overwhelming mandate, will people still feel that way about the protests against his policies? I don't think we know the answer to that. The second thing is, how will he react? Will he be willing to challenge these people in the streets and deal with the negative publicity that would come from that? In the past, French presidents have been very unwilling to come down to confrontations in the street. And when enough people have come out in protest against the policy, they've generally abandoned it. And they always say, well, what we'll do is we'll water it down or we'll try it again later. But they never really come back to it. This is a pattern of French political life for the last 20 years or so. So the question again with Sarkozy is, does he have the fortitude to stand in the face of those things, to accept a degree of unpopularity, and to push these things through anyway? I think, you know, if anybody can do it, it's Nicolas Sarkozy, but it's not clear that anyone can.
Well, his predecessor, and do correct me if I'm wrong here, I think Jacques Chirac has been president for 12 years? Is that?
That's right, yeah, he was president for 12 years.
For 12 years. So at this point, I suppose there's no telling whether Mr. Sarkozy, whether we could expect that he could be around for that much time, whether this is whether people get tired of him,
or change in the French Constitution, the terms are now 5 years, so he could serve 2 5-year terms potentially.
So he could be around for 10 years, providing, of course, that the French people don't get fed up with him somewhere.
Yeah.
After the first 5 years.
That's right. There's a further complication, which is that's the term of the president. There's also elections, legislative elections, at most every 5 years. If things go very badly, he can be forced to call another legislative election, and he could conceivably lose control over his own government. The system that the French call cohabitation, which means living together with the other party, it's a system that everybody else calls paralysis, and it's what happened to a large part of Jacques Chirac's term, about 5 years out of his 12. He was like that. And it was specifically because of these types of street protests that he ended up in that situation. So it's not clear that even if Sarkozy maintains office, that he can maintain control over the political system.
We have a couple of callers. Let's bring them into the conversation. First is someone in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning. I've been thinking about why Chirac is so adamant about keeping Turkey out of the EU. And I've come to the conclusion that I think he is frustrated by the inability of France to integrate its Muslim visitors, citizens who have come from the North Africa countries. And I just wondered, in general, what is happening in the EU? You know, what does the Constitution require? And if indeed Turkey had joined the EU, how much of a complication would that be toward integrating first the guest workers and to the people who have come from the North African countries into France? And of course, in Turkey, there were a lot of Turks who came to work in Germany and have for many, many years. And I wondered, under the EU, does it make their status that of citizen since they have lived so long in Germany? So if you could help me understand that, please.
Sure, I can try. There's a lot there. First of all, Jacques Chirac was not against Turkish membership into the EU. As a matter of fact, he was for it.
I think maybe the caller was thinking of Mr. Sarkozy.
Mr. Sarkozy is.
He definitely is against it.
Definitely is against it. Which is a big change in their policies. it's his view, just to sort of give credit to what he says, at least, that the reason that, Turkey is not ready for Europe and that Europe is not ready for Turkey. And what he means by that is that Turkey is too too backward, both in its economic development and its political development, to satisfy the qualifications of EU membership. And perhaps more importantly, that the EU hasn't developed sufficiently and is still taking in the previous enlargements. The EU has gained 12 new countries in the last 3 years. To be able to integrate as large a country as Turkey into institutions which aren't, in his view, working terribly well already. Now, it's quite clear, as the caller implied, that the question of the problems that France is having with its Muslim immigrants also affect that stance. I think it needs to be said in Sarkozy's defense that he's not one who tends to just follow public opinion. But it is the case, conveniently at least, that French public opinion is very, very against Turkish membership in the EU, as is frankly public opinion in the vast majority of Europe. When Jacques Chirac was trying to get the French to pass the Constitution, the European Constitutional Treaty 2 years ago in 2005, something they ultimately refused to do, he amended the French Constitution to say that any further enlargement of the EU would have to be approved by referendum of the French people. And he was specifically trying to give a signal to the French people that it would no longer be the case that the European Union would enlarge without them having any say. They felt like they hadn't had a say in the previous enlargements that I just mentioned. And so what that means for the future is that Turkey will only enter the EU by a vote of the French people. And because the relations with the Muslim population in France are so difficult, and because Turkey is essentially viewed, particularly in France, but in lots of parts of Europe, as a Muslim country, and because, of course, EU membership means free labor mobility, which means people can move as much as they want in between countries of the European Union, there is a huge reluctance to allow a country like that into the European Union. It would be the biggest country in the European Union if it was admitted. So I think the with Sarkozy's election, with that amendment to the French Constitution, Turkish membership has become very problematic. He, however, has not indicated that he's going to try to stop the process. He's just indicated that he's against it resulting in membership.
And what status do this free movement of labor across borders, what status do these people have? Do they become citizens eventually, or they just always have a visitor, guest worker status? How does that work?
No, they don't become citizens, but if you're talking about labor movement from one European Union country to another,
right.
They would be, I think, probably equivalent to green card holders, maybe is a good way of thinking about it, which is you have the right to work in any European Union country, and you have the right to live there. So you don't need, when you move across a border, it's just like moving, really, from Illinois to Wisconsin. You don't need to register or anything. You can just go and present your Illinois driver's license, and you can get a job. There's some... in terms of voting, people tend to vote in their home countries. You can vote in the local elections in the country that you're staying in, or living in. But then you vote in the national elections in the country that you're from, and you tend to remain a citizen of the country you're from. But it actually doesn't have that much impact on your life.
How about things like participation in the unions and medical care, education, things of that sort?
Yeah, there is, as part of the free movement of labor, there is essentially a principle of non-discrimination, which means that except in very rare cases like the government, employers and any kind of organization can't discriminate against people who are from other countries in the European Union. So yes, they can essentially join any organization that would be open to, say, a French citizen.
And education and healthcare.
All of those things, yeah, all of those things. Because anything that would be seen as a bar to labor movement isn't allowed. And the European Commission does enforce such things, or does try to enforce such things. Not to say that some problems don't persist, but I think what we're demonstrating here is that in order to have true free labor movement, you have to have some really very major reforms of a society. And that's why you can try to imagine what it would be like if we tried to have this system with Mexico, where any Mexican citizen could essentially move here and be entitled to all the privileges of an American citizen, essentially. That would require very profound reforms of our society and would be very culturally difficult.
But that's what
the European Union is attempting to do, and really to a large extent has done within the Union. So the question of admitting Turkey into an environment like that is a very, very difficult one for them.
Well, I do fear that if Turkey doesn't join the EU, that it might get polarized and become less of a secular country and more of a religious country. And I think that I worry that the cultural freedom and the religious freedom in Turkey might get polarized.
I think there's a great possibility of that. It's quite clear that Turkey, which has come quite a distance in the last few years in terms of economic and political reform, has done it because they have the lure of European Union membership to, let's say, inspire those reforms and to keep everybody in line. And that's been very, very useful for reformers in Turkey. And if we reach a place where European Union membership is no longer possible for Turkey, I think you're quite right that there could be some very disturbing political trends. One could be an increasing religiosity, a turn toward radical Islam. An equally present possibility is a turn toward a more authoritarian military government. And I think everybody is very, very nervous about the political development of Turkey, which, after all, is a hugely important country, not just for Europe, but for the United States. And so, of course, from the U.S. perspective, we very, very much want to keep alive the prospect of EU membership, which seems to have such a disciplining effect on Turkish politics. And the EU, of course, is aware of this, too. But on the popular level, what we're asking them to do is to admit a poor country with 80 million citizens who are very culturally distinct from them and give these people free labor movement into Turkey. That is a very, very difficult sell among European populations. And so it's going to be a struggle. I think at the moment, nobody is really talking about Turkish membership in the EU for another 10 years at least. So this is going to be an ongoing struggle for at least the next 10 years.
We are a bit past our midpoint here. I hope the caller will forgive me. I have a couple of other people holding I want to get to. Let me again introduce our guest, Jeremy Shapiro. He is a fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution in Washington. He's director of research at the Center on the U.S. and Europe there. He is also an adjunct professor of security studies at Georgetown University. And we're talking about France and French politics. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's go next to someone in Champaign on a cell phone here, line two. Hello.
Hello. Let's get back to French politics. But I happened to hear a group of financial advisors on another station other than WILL who always extol the virtues of capitalism. And after President Sarkozy won, they triumphantly proclaimed that finally the French understand the virtues of capitalism over socialism. Just asking you, was that an overly simplistic analysis of President Sarkozy's win, or was that did that hit the hammer or the nail on the head?
Well, I would say when you ask an analyst whether something's overly simplistic, he will always say yes. So I won't depart from that stereotype. Certainly, that's overly simplistic. The French, first of all, has really always been a capitalist country, or certainly for the last 50 years, and they do believe in private enterprise, probably somewhat less than the United States. And Sarkozy does represent a move in that direction, I think, toward a more toward, as he puts it, rewarding work, rewarding success. He still is not. Let's say, an American laissez-faire capitalist in the true tradition, because he still has a lot of beliefs in some of the traditional roles of the French state in the economy, particularly in protecting French companies, what they call in France national champions, which are the sort of large companies that symbolize French strength, in protecting them from takeovers and from competition. So he's definitely a believer in a certain type of industrial policy which has deep roots in France and which isn't very recognized here. Where he is certainly more capitalist is in his efforts to free up the French labor market, particularly. It's very, very difficult to hire and fire workers in France. Because of government regulation. And this has been identified for a very long time as a serious impediment to French growth. And he's quite resolved, as I said, as French presidents have been in the past, but he's actually resolved to do it, to liberalize that market. So I guess I agree, this does represent a move in the capitalist direction. I don't think it represents a major change in French thinking on this issue.
Thank you, sir.
All right, let's go to line 3 for another caller, Urbana. Hello.
I have a question about Darfur. I'm not sure if you covered that in the early part of the discussion.
Yeah.
I read recently that the French were involved in supporting the refugees in Chad that came from Darfur. And my sense was that Dr. Kouchner had a fairly strong interest in the problem of Darfur. And I wanted to ask you, what do you think the French might be willing to do in terms of taking a more prominent role towards the solution of the Darfurian crisis? And if so, what do you think the U.S. involvement might be? As you well know, the U.S. and many African ventures have left the front, the French and others take a lead role, but have
right.
supported logistically those efforts. And I was just wondering how you think this might take shape.
That's a very good question. I suppose I wish I knew the answer. I think that there is likely to be a lot of movement in the French position on Darfur. But the tensions are such that it's hard to really pinpoint what it will be. The new foreign minister, who you just mentioned, Bernard Kouchner, he's a very, very well known in the humanitarian community. He's the founder of the humanitarian group Doctors Without Borders, and he's been very, very active in the movement to do something about Darfur and to put increased pressure on the Sudanese government. So one would expect that him being appointed foreign minister, which was a very interesting appointment. He is a socialist. He's from the Socialist Party, and so essentially Sarkozy reached into the other party and brought across this very, very prominent man with a very distinct position on these types of issues. So his presence in the government would make one think that maybe the French position on Darfur would change. But it's unclear, from my perspective at least, what precisely that change could be. The French have long had troops in Chad, and they have certainly They've been very concerned about Darfur because they're concerned about the instability that it's importing into Chad. But they really don't have the military capacity or the political will to deal with a problem as vast as Darfur without a lot of international support. They probably don't also don't have the political capital to lead a major mission like that without American support. And so I'm unclear what difference Kushner's presence in the government can make. In fact, the Chirac policy was always somewhat forward-leading on Darfur, but again, without great consequence. We might see Sarkozy trying to influence the Americans on this issue, but again, I think Darfur is the kind of issue that everybody wants to do something about, but nobody wants to be in the lead. And I don't see the French really taking a lead on this, but you know, I think this is the type of issue where a lot of energy from the top, if Sarkozy suddenly becomes convinced, can make a big difference. So I guess we'll see.
Thank you.
All right. To another caller here. This is Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. I think in that last call there was an implicit idea in your response to assessing the military capabilities is that there is a military solution to Darfur, which is rather implausible. Alex Vanderwall, I guess, and Mahmoud Mamdani would be a good good interviews for that issue. But about France,
I certainly didn't mean to suggest that there is a military solution to Darfur. I don't believe that. I think what there is a lot of political pressure to have a military solution, and politicians do respond to that from time to time. And I think it's also the view of a lot of people in the humanitarian community, including Kushner, that there is at least an important part of the solution would be military. So it's an issue that comes up. I wouldn't think that particularly a mission with France in the lead, which would be by necessity under-resourced, would really be a long-term solution to the Darfur problem. I would agree with you.
In a different way, but they're also implicated as being a post-colonial power in the region, which is maybe why they shouldn't be take a lead. But I don't know that Sarkozy would be sympathetic to that. I want to get back to this whole idea of just calling something reform. The idea that the students and the younger workers were and their concern about their own precariousness, I guess that was the motto of the day, that resonates in with the worker, a lot of workers in France. Solidarity with people in the streets over that issue reflects preoccupation with the idea that, you know, enterprise isn't just for the bottom line, it's for the workers, and that the state should protect. So there's a premise that, you know, what's called over there the Anglo-Saxon model is by nature reform, but that's the contested zone. And I think that the fact that the socialists actually gained seats, not enough to affect the majority, but at least they'll be able to, particularly with some alliances with other parties who have other issues, but who are, again, not willing to embrace the so-called Anglo-Saxon model that makes workplace flexibility. Please.
It's definitely the case that this notion of solidarity, this notion of the state's role in protecting people against economic insecurity, is a really important one in France. Actually, I think it's important in the United States, but it's even more important in France. And it was very much, I think, what the election was about, this presidential election. The Ségolène Royal was offering a sort of a continuation of that, and Sarkozy said that that's important, but basically we are having economic problems. We are no longer able to afford it. He accused Ms. Royal of wanting to redistribute money that they didn't have, and you know, this was something that really cut to the heart of the French dilemma. People are, in general, happy with the way that France runs, but people had also become convinced that it could not continue as it was because simply the growth wasn't there, the jobs weren't there. And so they opted, you know, by a 53% vote for a candidate who very distinctly, very overtly promised that he would move them to some degree away from this state protection model, certainly not completely, but in the direction away from it. And so, I mean, I think that that is an accurate reflection both of the split views on this subject in France, but also of where the majority is. And what we're going to see in the fall is the specific people who are affected by these reforms, who will inevitably oppose them, coming out and sort of challenging that majority, slight majority opinion. And we're going to have to see how that works out, whether Sarkozy is able to push these things through. But I think it's important to understand that what he reflects is a now fairly newly majoritarian view in France that reform is necessary, perhaps unfortunate, but necessary.
Well, the opposite argument I would make, or a different argument I would make, is that there were other issues at stake, and the demagoguery about immigration that we see here is also palpable there. So you could actually make the argument that the margin of the vote that you're calling a slim margin for reform is actually reflects these so-called other non-economic issues.
That's always possible, but what's really very interesting about this campaign is just how sort of open and substantive it was. I watched the final debate in the days before the election. It was nearly 3 hours long. It almost killed me. And it was really very much down in the weeds about these particular issues. It wasn't terribly demagogic, and even when the issue of immigration came up, both candidates really did sort of refuse to engage in that kind of thing. So there were fringe candidates who did. And I think what you saw in the French electorate, it was somewhat different than a U.S. election. You saw people desperately interested in being informed on the issues, really just continually tuning into French television programs, which offered hours and hours of in-depth coverage on substantive issues on these things. And then, of course, you saw, as was pointed out, an 85% participation rate. That was a participation rate, by the way, that was up about 15% from the previous election, which indicates that people were extremely interested in what the candidates were talking about and the candidates themselves.
Well,
if any election can be said to be reflective of what people felt on substantive issues, this was it.
Well, I would argue again that some were paying attention to that, but the demographics actually show that Le Pen lost, and that a lot of Le Pen voters who would respond to the imagery of being anti-immigrant and draconian, et cetera, were somewhat pivotal. I wonder if in the election for the parliament just recently, there may have been some right wingers and sort of nativist kind of response that was suppressed when this, as well as the VAT tax being floated, which annoyed a lot of people, but also Sarkozy was found to have had hired sans-papiers, illegals, in his restoration of his new dwelling or something like that. So the hypocrisy.
The legislative elections don't appear to reflect that because Le Pen's party was wiped out. They didn't get any seats, actually. You're certainly right that there is abundant nativist sentiment in France. And it's always, an election is always like tea leaves. You can read pretty much anything you want into it. But I do think that ultimately a candidate runs on a platform. He gets elected on a platform. He probably has a duty and certainly a mandate to implement that platform. So one of the interesting things about Sarkozy as a politician, he says this over and over again, and I guess I believe him, is that he actually intends to do what he said he was going to do. His campaign was fairly detailed and quite explicit. And so I guess, you know, politics is always a process. He will be attempting to implement what the people voted on in May. He will be attempting to implement that in the fall, and there will probably be protests. And how the public responds to that protest will be yet more evidence about the issue that we're talking about, whether people actually support reform. And I agree, it's an open question, because people, I think, certainly in France, people support reform in the abstract, but often not in the specific, like anywhere else.
We have about 5 minutes left here. I want to, just in the few minutes we have left, have you talk a little bit about the relationship between France and the United States. I'm certain that the Bush administration was pleased that Ségolène Royal did not win. At the same time, there certainly are issues that divide Mr. Sarkozy from the Bush people. He's, like other French leaders, has not supported American policy in Iraq. He has, one of the things that he has said that he wants to pay some attention to is global warming, and has been critical of the United States for not dealing with that issue. So certainly there would be points of disagreement. I think at the same time, some people, there's some kind of interesting speculation that with Tony Blair fading from the scene, that it could be that France might in some way take the place of or come to rival Britain as being America's most important ally. What do you think that the relationship is going to be like between the Bush administration and Mr. Sarkozy and his government?
I think that, you know, everything is relative. From the standpoint of the U.S. government, the election of Sarkozy was, a vast improvement on Jacques Chirac, who was very, very disliked by the U.S. government, and B, as you pointed out, far preferable to the election of Ségolène Royal. But I don't think the U.S. government fools itself in understanding that Sarkozy, as the French president, he's definitely the most instinctually pro-American French president that they've had in the post-war era, it can really move the French population, which has a great deal of suspicion toward the United States. Sarkozy was again explicit in his campaign that he didn't believe in the sort of reflexive American bashing which often characterizes French politics, and that he wanted to have a more constructive relationship with the United States. And I think he will, but he was also quite explicit that he thought that French independence, which is a critical point of the sort of Gaullist philosophy that Sarkozy comes from, is something that he will maintain. And what that means is he will tell the United States when he disagrees on issues like global warming, on issues like Iraq, and on issues, by the way, like Turkey. So I think we can expect to see a continued relationship where France is supportive of the United States under certain circumstances, where I think maybe the government-to-government relations are somewhat better, but where France maintains its independence. It will never be like Britain, which is a country that very often supports the United States simply because it is the United States.
Hmm. So you don't see a big shift, you think, in
I don't see a big shift. And part of the reason is because actually French-American relations are better than is often assumed. They actually work very, very well together on a daily level. Iraq was obviously a disaster for the relationship, but it was actually sort of the exception. And on the sort of lower-level issues that don't engage the public, they have long worked very well together in places like Lebanon, Afghanistan, Iran. And so I expect that to continue. I expect them to be a little bit better at working together because the presidents will get along, and that will make a difference on the margin. But I don't expect any dramatic shifts, and I don't expect the relationship to get so good that we can expect a special relationship like we have with the United Kingdom.
Mm. Just for a minute, to go back to Turkey, which we talked about earlier, it's proven very controversial, the idea of Turkey coming into the EU. There are a number of roadblocks, and this would, in even if there were, if it was going to happen, it would be a long process. It would be a 10-year-long process. And certainly having Mr. Sarkozy, who says that he doesn't favor Turkey's admission, even though he says, I'm not going to block this, I don't approve of it. That I don't suppose that helps. But, you know, given the fact that we are talking about something that would take a long time anyway, how problematic is it, do you think, that right at the moment there do indeed seem to be a lot of Europeans who are opposed to the idea simply because they say Turkey is not a European country?
How problematic do I think it is?
Yeah, I mean, do you think that in fact we actually could actually see things, see it working out so that in fact Turkey would eventually join the EU?
Yeah, you know, I guess I would agree with you if I understand the direction of your question, that there is a certain risk that the European Union will be too willing to take Turkey. The European Union has a history of doing things for sort of technocratic reasons, things that are agreed on by the political class that the populations really aren't ready for. Actually, the last enlargement, where they took in 8 Eastern European countries and 2 islands, was something that made the Union more unpopular among its people, because the people really didn't want it, and they did it anyway without asking them. And you can see that in the Turkey strategy. They keep saying to people, look, we don't need to make a decision. Let's just advance the process one more step, and then we'll see what happens. Yeah. And this is what they call in Europe the salami slicing tactics. They keep moving closer and closer to membership, and eventually they say to people, gee, we've gotten so far. I guess we have no choice but to go ahead. I think that there are a lot of people, and Sarkozy has pointed this out, that are worried that that's actually what the European Union is attempting to do with Turkey. And it's actually been a successful enough strategy in the past that I think it would be, I support Turkish membership in the European Union, but I think it would be a very bad idea for for the European Union to admit Turkey against the will of the large majority of its population, which is where the population stands right now.
Well, there we're going to have to leave it. Our guest, Jeremy Shapiro, is Director of Research at the Center on the U.S. and Europe at the Brookings Institution in Washington. Mr. Shapiro, thank you very much.
Thank you.